Hey, everybody. Welcome to Defy. This is a podcast about stories, because everyone has a story to tell. We're all about sharing stories of women and non-binary individuals and how they have defined the odds, persevered through incredible circumstances, and transformed their lives. Is this a show about perfection? No, because it doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? No, that is not our style. This is a show about breaking the rules, creating your own path, and being your true self. Because remember, well-behaved women rarely make history. Non-binary folks excel at breaking models. So come on, let's get out there and defy. Okay, so what's up, everybody? Welcome to Defy, and I'm excited because today on our podcast, we have our first Defy Reads featured author. It's a very fancy term. The lovely and incomparable Tiffany Bloom. What's up, girl?
Hey.
So
glad to be here.
I am so glad that you're here too. Okay, so let's talk about like what a big deal you are. So like you're such a big deal now. Like I couldn't actually like schedule through you directly. I had to go through your publicist, Shelly, who is a revelation and very lovely and accommodating. And so this is, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, like, I don't know. Am I ready for this kind of like celebrity status on Defy? Like, I'm not sure. But then I remembered like, oh my gosh, the first time that you and I talked, you had on like your 80s scrunchie. So like, it's all good. And we're friends.
I see how that could be confusing for you, that after we have a conversation, I'm like, oh, please book through my publicist.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, I can't. I'm so popular. Like, I just can't respond to these emails. So you're just going to have to go through Shelly. Okay. So we're really excited that we are going to be featuring your new book, Pray Tell, for Defy Reads. And we're going to be having a reading with you on March 30th. And we'll give all of that information out to our members later. But I wanted to have you on the podcast just because, A, you like to podcast just like me. You have a podcast. Why, though? What do you guys talk about and why, though?
Oh, you know, everything from our favorite frozen pizza to our favorite charcuterie boards to systemic injustice. It's a little bit column A, a little bit column B. We keep it real.
I did. I listened to a couple episodes and I was like, where have you been all my life? And why have we not been best friends since forever?
I mean, right?
Yeah. I mean, like when the first time you and I talked, I was like, okay, like, you know, we have this common friend, Anna Mischke, and Anna's like, hey, I really think that you would like Tiffany and like the vibe that she's throwing down and the things that are important to her. And I'm like, okay. You know, so I had like no expectations, right? It's like a blind date. I was like, well, I mean, worst case scenario, it's a 1 hour out of my life and I can like go on living my life and it's no big deal. But literally like, as soon as we started talking, I was like, oh my gosh. Like there's so many parallels and you have such great energy and I think we're both passionate about the same things. And then the hour flew by. So I was really looking forward to sitting down with you today to just kind of have our community get to know you a little better. And honestly, what I'm really interested in talking with you about today is a conversation about faith, because that's something that we haven't really covered in the Defy podcast. And this is, of course, like a cornerstone of who you are. And I think I shared with you when we first talked, I grew up in the Presbyterian church and my, you know, church family and experiences were integral parts of my, you know, childhood, young adulthood, et cetera. But as I've gotten older and, you know, kind of moved away from my family, you know, my faith journey has kind of evolved and been different. And so I'm really excited to have an honest conversation with you about that as well. But if you will indulge me,
yes,
what I wanted to read is a small excerpt from your book, because I think this is just going to provide a really nice framework for the conversation that we can have today. Perfect. And I thought that this was really compelling. And it's so funny, you guys, I got like the advanced copy of this book. And so like I messaged Tiffany on Instagram. I was like, okay, this copy says like, do not share this manuscript. You know, this is not the final copy. Like if you share this with anyone, like we're going to send people to your house and they're going to take it away from you. I was like, Tiffany, like, am I allowed to talk about this? You're like, well, you can maybe wait closer to when, you know, the book is going to be released in March. I was like, okay. But then I read it within like the first 48 hours. So I'm going to start with this. You see, for the majority of my life, I had made it my mission to keep men who held power in my life pleased with me, to stay on their good side and to do as I was told. I played by their rules and hardly questioned their authority. Every boss I've ever had, except for one, thank you to the beautiful Korean woman who managed the Quiksilver outlet. We love her. Has been a well-resourced white man. Every pastor I've ever had, including my grandfather, has been a white man. And on top of that, in nearly every setting I grew up in, I was the only minority, the token brown girl in a sea of snow white. My nickname in high school, printed on the back of my Cheers sweatshirt and catcalled through the halls, I kid you not, was brown girl. As an agreeable, conflict-avoidant woman of color, rather than voice any concern when I spotted discrepancies or experienced othering, I mastered silencing my own voice in order to be of value to the world around me, especially to the men who employed or pastored me. So let's start kind of unpacking this. And I think this, again, was a really great place to start in terms of telling your story. Your name is Tiffany. And when we first talked, Jay, who is from Kerala, India, I was like, Tiffany's Indian, Jay. And he's like, she's not Indian. Tiffany's not an Indian name. I'm like, just because someone doesn't have an Indian name doesn't mean that they're not Indian. So let's start at the beginning of your adoption. Where were you born? And then where did you grow up?
Yeah. So I was left on a doorstep in Delhi, India. And at 2 days old, and taken in by this beautiful woman who I met when I was 30 because she tracked me down, Sarah.
No.
The woman who took me in at 2 days old tracked me down. She's been looking for me for 10 years. Yeah. So I was taken in, and just shy of my second birthday, I was adopted to the States to a rural community, white family, two older brothers, and started this new little life where no one looked like me. I had my black Teresa Barbie doll, and it was her and I on the open road, and that was it. Really nobody. So I never saw myself reflected in anyone, and I truly despised not only my beginning, but my skin. So I had this crisis, identity crisis of just being brown and everyone being white and people not wanting to play with me on the playground because I was brown. They thought that they'd get dirty. You know, nobody would want to eat the cookies I brought to the Valentine's Day party because they thought they'd be dirty because I brought them and I'm brown. To then hit 9/11 and everything changed for me. Everything I felt about myself, everyone very much agreed with those same feelings. That feeling of I don't belong here was echoed and mirrored by everyone in high school and at my workplace. I worked for a retirement community and they were all World War II vets and they refused to let me serve them their food anymore because they were convinced I was a terrorist and I was going to kill them. And I was just trying to find a way to pass algebra. So this growing up of constantly feeling like I'm not supposed to be here, but where am I supposed to be? I don't feel Indian in America and I don't meet the cultural expectations that other Indians have when they meet me. I even have a neighbor. She's always like, oh, but don't you miss? And she'll fill in the blank of some wonderful snack. I'm like, just a reminder, I was institutionalized. I was left on a doorstep and then raised with, you know, a couple other hundred kids who weren't hardly fed. So it's not exactly the picture perfect idea of India. And then I have a Greek first name and a Jewish last name, Tiffany Bloom. You would never guess as I'm walking into a room that I'm Indian or that I'm an immigrant. And so just kind of coming with this experience and not finding a place to rest that, not finding a place where I truly belonged. And again, just as you read, contorting myself to be accepted by majority culture. And I had done it so subconsciously that not until I was an adult did I realize my entire life has been to be accepted by other people. And I wouldn't consider myself an insecure person, needy, looking for people to like me. That's not really who I am. So I wouldn't have been able to put it in those words. But the idea of, because I sound like you, because my accent is similar to yours, because I have the same interest for you. I also went through the Doc Martin phase and the Gap sweatshirt phase. I have this shared collective understanding of what it was like to live through the 90s and early 2000s. I can camp on that and I can build connection with that. So I really, I mean, call me an optimist, but it's built a resiliency in me to be able to make connection and find common ground. And I really do believe that that's one of my greatest giftings is to find common ground with anybody. Put me in an airport lounge and I will make a friend. I will find common ground. I can do it. I don't care where you're from. You're from Tulsa and you work in engineering. We'll find something to talk about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it made me tender and it made me aware of those on the margins or those who often don't get to have a voice, who don't get to speak up. And I wish I would have known of women who made great gains in history, but this was also pre-internet, remember? So I wasn't exposed to the world except my immediate little rural community, where I didn't meet another person of color, Sarah, until I was in middle school. And there was some twins, they're black. And I remember thinking like, there's more people like me, and not even Indian, but just somebody not white, not white. So spending the majority of my adolescence longing to be something I would never be and pretending to ignore something of really who I was is definitely not a healthy self-awareness, but it really has in my adult years given me eyes to see how not only screwed up it is that we really have valued white men, white women, and then everyone else, and truly women of color, really at the bottom of the rung. Mm-hmm. But what it's going to take to change that systemically, because I think charity is great. I think systemic change is better.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And this is something that we talk about a lot in the DeFi community. And even this month, I mean, we're recording this in February. It's Black History Month, and our team, internal team, is a very diverse group of women that come from, you know, all different parts of the U.S. and, you know, not the U.S. and have all different types of, you know, identities layered on top of their identity as women. And one of the things that has been so important for us is to do things that are not performative. Right. And to really do things that have impact, but that is, it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of hard conversations. There's been a lot of tears. It requires an incredible vulnerability. And I guess one of the things that really struck me about you is there is, your resiliency is palpable when people talk to you, when people interact with you. I mean, I noticed it right away when we talked, and you have this almost like tractor beam of energy that kind of, you know, brings people in, and again, like, can find, you know, those pathways of similarity or, you know, overlap that allows you to then, you know, kind of deepen that connection. Where do you think that comes from? I mean, cause like, and I talk about this with my kids too. So you're an adoptive mom and I'm an adoptive mom. And then you were adopted yourself. And some of the things sometimes I notice with my own children is there's the nature and the nurture piece, right? Wow. I mean, there's stuff that my daughter says and I'm just like, oh my gosh, she's like literally my mini me. But then there's things that she might say or my son might say. And I'm just like, where, you know, this is like such a unique thing to you. Like, where, I don't know, where's the genetic footprint that was born into you from this? Like, what would I give to be able to have, you know, like 10 minutes, like with your birth parents, just to kind of get a better glimpse into you? What do you think, you know, in terms of those resiliency habits and the ability to connect, do you think it's nature or nurture? Where do you think that comes from for you that's allowed you? Because I agree, this is a huge gift that you have to really like bring people into you so they can really hear and absorb your messages.
Yeah, I got to be honest, that resiliency really came from mentoring. I had incredible people step in. My adopted family, it was a pretty rough upbringing, to be completely honest with you. Mm-hmm. And so it was mentors in junior high who stepped in, and I thought, I need a vision for my life of who I'm going to become, and I'm seeing healthy people. I'm gonna chase after that. So it was this understanding of healthy people not only love themselves, but they know how to love others in a healthy way, in a way that makes change. And so for me, that changed everything. And they were people of faith. So not only was I feeling seen and known, I didn't feel Indian in India, I didn't feel Indian in America, but I felt welcome at the table of faith for who I was and valued and respected, because potential is an equal opportunity employer, right? So being able to be seen who I was and my gifts and my skills and my abilities, and not only have those colors brought out of me, but also watching how they lived their lives and watching how they'd overcome and watching how they'd walked that out. And of course, these were, again, rural white people in the middle of nowhere. But just being loved by them and being able to see who I could become if I could learn to love and believe in myself and believe in what I had was good, not left over, not to be ashamed of, not a story to hide, but a story to celebrate. That I really could not only live a beautiful, glorious, wonderful, full, vibrant, juicy life, but that I could invite others to do the same.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you started your faith journey?
At middle school.
Okay. Yeah, middle school. Wait, so was this something that, like, did your family, like, hey, let's start going to church, or did you get invited from a friend? Like, where, like, what was like the first step?
So I grew up in a family of faith. I've heard a lot of millennials say it. Our parents went to church, but we didn't see life change at home, so we don't buy it. Mm-hmm. And so I was invited by a friend to middle school, to go to this youth ministry. And I remember this guy from the front just talking about kindness and love and acceptance and wholeness and mm-hmm. who you are is enough. And I'm like, if this is real, I'll give my whole life to this. I'll give mm-hmm. my whole life to this. I will not turn back. And so professionally, I pursued ministry as a career mm-hmm. because I was like, I'm going to spend myself on something. I want to spend myself on the faith. And it really has been my anchor and my driving force. And to be honest, it's how I get through the day. Yeah. These people call it a crutch. Very much so. It's a crutch I could never give up.
Yeah. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was prepping for this podcast is the whole idea that I think in our world right now, there's just so many divisive things. And we have, I especially watched, you know, over the last like 4 or 5 years, especially, and definitely, you know, through this pandemic and definitively through the last couple of presidential elections, that, you know, divisive culture, I'm on the left or the right, you know, looking for where are those, you know, common threads, where is that commonality? Where is the kind of more kind of centrism? Because chances are we have a lot more in common than we have.
Come on, Sarah. That's right.
You know, than we don't. And I feel like part of the reason for me personally that it's been hard for me to like lean into my faith, especially as an adult, is I see faith and especially Christianity associated with exclusion. Right. And so I'm wondering, like, how have you been able to kind of get this message across? Because you have this really cool thing. I noticed, like, on the Why Though podcast and on your Linktree and Instagram, that to church or not to church.
Yeah.
And I kind of just love conceptually how you have just kind of talked about, like, hey, like, here's how you might want to decide about this. Can you just kind of explain, right, like, yeah, what's to church or not to church, and yeah, and why might someone be interested in exploring this?
Yeah. I want to answer this in two parts. So first part of your question of the division, and really what you're seeing is not, that's not faith. That's Christian nationalism, which employs and celebrates individualism above collective care. And when you are far from the proximity of other people who are excluded, it's out of sight, out of mind. And it, again, it embodies and upholds your individual well-being, what schools your kids are going to, your resources, your 401k, your rights, quote unquote rights, your gun ownership, everything about you matters above the collective community that you reside in. Mm-hmm. And the faith could be nothing further from that. It is all about collective care and to give everything to ensure everybody that the mom across town living in a Motel 6, trying to get her kids to school to get to the post office on time, has everything good that you have. Mm-hmm. So this misuse and abuse of theological and scripture and language around Jesus and the idea of what he embodies is so grotesque and pervasive in culture. And it has nothing to do with an honest, beautiful faith in Jesus. He is for the downtrodden. He is for inclusion. He's in for inclusion. Mm-hmm. If we're created in his image, he's for us.
Yeah.
And so being able to see each and every person as beloved and long for them to have what we have, I want them to be well fed, access to medical care, in good schools, all the things that we would want. They deserve every good thing. So that individualism versus collective care is really the linchpin here that mm-hmm. has been hijacked by Christian nationalism. And that is a huge voting block. As you just mentioned, yep, it's this left versus right. It's a huge voting block. And it's disgusting how, because in truth, no party embodies the values and espouses the values of Jesus. And so you can't really grapple with one or the other. And mm-hmm. for me, when I was looking, especially just as you said, these last few elections, this feels like the powerful versus the oppressed.
Yeah.
Whether you look left or right, this is powerful versus the oppressed. This is the haves and the mm-hmm. have-nots. And it's the oppressed who've always led toward the line of justice. It is not those with power who want to sacrifice their place in the system that are going to move the arc of the universe toward justice. It is the oppressed in every movement across mm-hmm. every society, both Western, Eastern, Southern, Northern. It is the oppressed who move that. And so even as I think about why I wrote this book and why I'm passionate about this issue is because if we want to see change, we have to understand that movement is what really moves the ball down the court.
Yeah. Well, and I was just thinking while you were talking, you know, obviously, yeah, for people that are in power, it's this, you know, need to constantly, you know, ensure that you have your status to further your status. But fundamentally, this comes down to a lack of belief that abundance can be for everyone.
Come on.
That's right. You know what I mean? It's like abundance can be for everyone. There are enough, there's enough food, there's enough shelter, there's enough resources in this world to take care of everyone. So why are we acting like that's not the case?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and I'm just like, I'm fed up with this. Like we're doing this challenge right now in Defy for 30 days with this, with Visor app. It's actually really cool. And I will take 30 seconds to explain to you what this is because this is how stoked I am about it. Visor app, they got $500,000 of, you know, seed money to start this app. It's a nonprofit organization. And essentially what they do is they track your, like they use your Fitbit or iWatch to track your fitness goals. So whether you do like 30 minutes of exercise or 10,000 steps per day, you can log into the app. And by basically taking care of yourself, every time you work out for those 30 minutes or get those 10,000 steps, Pfizer will donate a food to someone experiencing food insecurity. Yeah, I know. It's like, it's what? So... And it's gamified, so you can earn points. And depending on where like you are geographically located, you could exchange these points to get like a free yogurt or maybe like a free entree, like at a cool like organic restaurant. And their whole thing is they want to democratize wellness. And I love this concept. And also, this is something that was founded by a young woman. I always love, you know, innovative tech ideas. But for me, what like struck me the most is I'm like, we've had to resort to like creating an app and gamifying it to, you know, really encourage people to take care of themselves so we can take care of others. And that especially during this pandemic, and then you've seen the statistics, especially as it relates to children.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many children in the United States. This isn't about India or, you know, Africa or other places that we associate with like third world or whatever other adjectives we want to attach to it. This is in the United States that there are, you know, I don't know if the statistic is like 1 in 5 children experience food insecurity here. Yeah. And I think, you know, what I'm hoping, and I feel like this, the seeds of this have really kind of started percolating over the last year. And especially what you saw, I think during last summer, is this idea that the oppressed are the ones that are going to, you know, basically are waving the flags of like, this is not okay. This, we can't go on like this isn't fair. And obviously the people that are in power are like, hey, we're going to do whatever we need to do to maintain this status. But I feel like we're slowly kind of, you know, realizing like we, in American culture, we are addicted to junk values right now. Junk values. We have children that don't have enough food to eat. Yeah. You know, we have other people, especially, you know, working women during the pandemic that have been, you know, are leaving the workforce en masse because there's no one to help take care of their children. And they were already paid less than potentially their spouses if they're married to like a cisgender man. So it's like, oh, hey girl, you're going to have to leave your job because like I make 20% more. So it's like, we're, you know, like what? So like the ravages of inequity have just been like thrown in our face front and center. And this really kind of weaves into, from my perspective, why Pray Tell is very timely. And I assume probably was kind of some of the impetus for you to write this, of like, we're all living this too. You're living the same like experience, you know, I am as a you know, working mother during this time. So can you just kind of talk a little bit more about like what else really inspired you to like really put, you know, pen to paper and say like, enough, but like also here's like a blueprint for like what we can do about this crap, especially as it relates to women.
Right. There really is an intersection when you think about the pandemic, just as you said, and how women are inordinately penalized during this time, emotionally, professionally, financially, relationally. And when you think about silencing women and an imbalance of power, because really this book is all about imbalance of power and men taking advantage of it and how it continually seeps into every system we're in. And if we don't address it, women are going to continually lose out. And I really, it makes me think about 100, almost 100 years ago during World War II, when men were shipped off to war and women were invited to fill those roles.
Rosie the Riveter.
We had the glamorous Rosie the Riveter inviting us to come and work in agriculture, munitions, office jobs, the whole nine yards. And then what did we face? We faced rampant sexual harassment and assault. We faced low pay, overworking 12, 13, 14 hours a day. And research shows that women of color were equally as recruited. So this is across the board, women everywhere. And of course, we know that women of color were treated even worse than white women in those situations. But as women gained agency, they realized there's more of us than there is of them, and we can demand better. And so now you fast forward 80 years later, and here we are, and this imbalance of power continues. Yet, of course, since 2017, since the Me Too movement, we're seeing not only is this imbalance of power continuing, it is derailing women's lives at such a rate that is so detrimental to society. It's research shows that sexual harassment in the workplace is the leading factor of destroying a woman's career long-term. Mm-hmm. Because not only does it destroy her personal well-being, it impacts her team, it impacts anyone she's working with, obviously impacts her home life, it impacts her children, it impacts her well-being, her understanding of self, her ability to get another job in the future, because mm-hmm. it's her word against his. This is a crisis. This is a crisis. And so addressing this issue of an imbalance of power, what happens is men are still getting away with it. And we've built these systems to enable men to continue to abuse their power. And we think that they might be flawed, but surely they're not doing the damage that they're really doing. Surely they're not that bad. So we're not examining bylaws in sacred or secular spaces, you know, business, entertainment, politics, in the church. We're not willing to examine these cultures of how we are continually enabling men to get away with this imbalance of power. And it's often happening to low wage earning women well before we had Gwyneth Paltrow, well before we had Ashley Judd, which I am so glad they came forward and they are leaders in this movement. But well before we had them, we had women at McDonald's making an hourly wage corralled into the bathroom on their 10-minute break and forced to give blowjobs to their managers, or they're told they'd lose their jobs, and they're trying to feed their babies at home. So we're seeing this happen in every sector, and there really has to be a reckoning beyond just a hashtag. There has to be bylaw change. There has to be policy change. There has to be systemic change. And it's not, I get that this is not a warm, fuzzy topic, but this affects half the world, the world.
Well, technically more than half, because we make up more than half of the world.
Of course we do. And which is surprising considering infanticide in all these developing worlds. Carry on.
One of the things that I did really appreciate about your book, because you are looking at this from a faith lens, is the concept in especially Christianity that, well, we should just forgive.
Right.
And that absolves everything. And I am, you know, I am someone that one of the things that has definitely rooted me throughout my entire life is the idea that no matter what I do in this world, that I am still worthy of love and forgiveness and compassion. And those, to me, like, those are values regardless of the struggles that I've had with my faith. I will never abandon that, because I think fundamentally that is like the only hope that you have in the world, since we are flawed people.
Right.
But I see so much in the church, and you talk about this very specifically, that it's, of course, we want to forgive. Of course, we want to understand that people can make mistakes. But I think what has happened a lot in faith communities is we have used this forgiveness as a way to just kind of wipe everything away.
We've weaponized it.
Uh-huh.
Weaponized it. We have, you know, in the scripture that I quote, I talk about how King David in the Old Testament he sexually assaulted a woman while she was cleansing herself after her time of the month. He saw her, he sent his messenger. So that means other people were witness to what he was doing. Other people knew exactly what his plans were, and they said nothing. They were bystanders, no intervention. He takes advantage of her, impregnates her, kills her husband. And now in modern day, we use this story as, well, oh, but he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to forgive. And really the text, this Old Testament text, has a whistleblower, a male ally named Nathan, going before this king and saying, I know what you did. You better repent, which is to say sorry, to turn from your ways. Repent means turn from your way. And he lost so much. His son tried to take over his throne. He lost so much of his kingdom. Even the Ancient of Days, even God, doesn't let bygones be bygones, right? There are consequences. Mm-hmm. And in our modern day, we line our CEOs and our pastors with cash. We give them a bulky severance. We send them on their way, and there's no restitution. There's no recompense and redress for a woman's experience. And in reality, we need to be pursuing legal justice, financial justice. If she had to take time off, if she lost her job, we need to be pursuing justice at her expense, because it's so easy to be like, but just forgive him. He did a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And really, a narcissistic man who's abusing his power and platform and privilege is banking on us playing the forgiveness card, no matter what sector of society we're in.
Yeah.
Because he's groomed us enough to think, I have more power than you, and you know it. Mm-hmm. So you forgive me and we're going to move on.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up the narcissistic man, and you alluded to this in your book. And I, you know, I'd emailed you ahead of the podcast, and I was like, I want to know more. There's a personal narrative that you weave throughout Pray Tell. Can you just kind of like elaborate a little bit on this and why you felt like it was really important to really talk about this?
Before I do, I just want to say, I am a 3 on the Enneagram, diplomatic, agreeable, get along with everyone. I am never the girl that anyone would think to speak up and like raise the banner for a human rights issue like that. Nobody would accuse me of that. Although justice runs through my veins, to put myself in a controversial spot where I lost everything, I wouldn't have penned myself as that person. But lo and behold, when you're put between a rock and a hard place, believe it or not, bravery and courage really does come out. So that's great. So many moons ago, I found myself in an impossible situation in the system I was in, where I discovered impropriety among senior leadership. Mm-hmm. And I knew speaking truth to power as a bystander, not as the victim, but as a bystander, lending my strength to this victim, I would lose my place in the system. I would lose my proximity to power. I would lose my resources. Sarah, I was the breadwinner for my home at that point. Mm-hmm. I would lose everything. And for us, it was our community of where we did life with people, spent our time with people, got to know people. These were our friends. This is our community. And I knew I would lose everything. I mean, I'd lose my health insurance, for God's sake, 401k, everything.
Yeah.
And I sat with this secret under this news of misconduct for about 6 months, and it destroyed me from the inside out. I was having night terrors. I was puking in the middle of the night. Couldn't sleep. Sleep was very much not an escape from my reality. And eventually, you know, secrets, we don't keep secrets. Secrets keep us. And eventually I spoke up to someone who had more power to handle it than I, and speaking truth to power. And I was silenced. I was disposable. This man was seen as indispensable. And although other women came forward, it was not seen as a reason to remove this man from his position. A couple years later, this man was removed from his position as more and more and more and more allegations came out. And it sucks to go first. It really sucks to go first. And everything that I thought I would lose, I did. And even looking back, I'm like, man, there was, you either go down with this sinking ship, and you have this moment where I have loyalty to this institution and I have loyalty to my convictions, and you weigh which one's going to win, because both one has consequences. You're either going down with the ship, or you're going to tell everyone what's going on the ship and watch it sink. And so either way, you're viewed as somebody who's done something wrong. You're guilty by association. And so being willing to speak up and losing more than I found out in the process, I discovered the emotional and societal and systemic and financial reasons we silence women in culture, in church communities, and what we can do about it. And it truly is a systemic issue. We create systems where if a woman is going to speak up against a man, we act like her speaking up is more indignant and a problem than the misconduct allegations.
Right.
Like you're rocking the boat, and that is more of an issue than any misconduct that you're bringing up. We sign away their silence. The most effective way to silence women is to have them sign on the dotted line, have them sign an NDA. And so what happens is we create systems where, oh, something poor happened, sign an NDA. You can't talk to your mentor, your therapist, your husband, your wife. You can't talk to anybody about it. You need to go on your merry way, and they're tortured, and they're not going to get the help they need for their PTSD. And then another unsuspecting, confident, capable, intelligent woman walks into this new system where she is going to be eaten alive because she has no idea that there's been payouts to all these other people. Or we create systems where if you do speak up, you'll be penalized. You'll lose opportunity. You'll lose resources. You'll lose your place at the water cooler. Mm-hmm. And as women, we want to honor the gatekeepers who let us in because we know what's on the line.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, especially the NDA, I mean, and you talked about this in your book, and I remember like the Harvey Weinstein thing, you know, like unfolding and just really, I mean, just the paper trail associated with that. Yeah. So it's like NDAs, money, you know, people didn't know. And then it was almost, I remember at one point you almost couldn't keep up with the volume. Once a couple women spoke up, it was, I mean, the floodgates were open. And I remember thinking to myself, like, of course, you know, I'm horrified and upset, but also I remember having a conversation. I got into an argument. I was dating this guy at the time and just kind of saying, like, every single woman I know, without exception, has a story. Mm-hmm. Maybe not to the same degree as Harvey Weinstein, but every single woman I know has experienced this. My own daughter was 10 years old. She was at summer camp, like a day camp, and she developed early. And I talked to her about this, you know, and just kind of about like, how do you protect yourself? Like, what are, and I remember my ex-husband like had kind of disagreed. He's like, I don't think you should be talking to her. She's 10 years old. And I was like, take it from me. Mm-hmm. I am telling you, she is this beautiful creature and she developed early, and people think that like, this is, you know, they felt like, oh, well then I want to touch you and see what this is. You know, I'm like, I am protecting my kid, 10 years old, summer camp, standing in a line, going from like one activity for another. Little boy turns around to her and says, hey, what's that on your chest? Touches her breasts. My kid, I love this story, cause this is like, this is my girl.
Oh.
She was like, excuse me. That is not your body. This is my body. You cannot touch me. And goes right away and talks to, gets a camp counselor. And it was just like, this kid touched my body, does not have my permission. This is not okay with me. And so like the camp counselor, I was in Las Vegas giving a presentation. I get this call and this camp counselor is like shaking in their boots because they are just worried that I'm going to like fly off the handle. They're like, Ms. Troutman, there was an incident today. And I was like, what happened? I mean, because it's like your mom, like, I'm like, just give it to me straight. Just give it to me straight. And they're like, so this would happen. This, you know, and something like, what did Tess do? And they're like, well, Tess, and I was like, that's my girl. I was like, yes, she stood up for herself. She's like, absolutely not. You do not have, consent to touch my body, you know, and I was so proud of her. But at the same time, I remember flying home and I just cried because I was like, I can't protect her. Mm-hmm. I can't protect my own kid. And she's 10.
Yeah.
And this is the first time that she's experienced this. And this is not the last time.
No.
And I don't accept this anymore. And another thing that you were talking about is just kind of like fundamentally, you know, looking at what we would say in like behavior analysis, or what are the different kind of contingencies that would make someone want to make one choice versus another choice. So what you were saying, that the different contingencies you had to deal with is like, if I do this, then I can, you know, lose my power, you know, lose my job, potentially lose, you know, the economic, you know, upward mobility that I'm bringing in my family. And like, these are the kind of choices that we're forced to make. And so much of this is all about like, we don't believe women.
Right. Right.
We don't believe multiple women
to come forward. We want, we don't want witnesses. We want victims. So we're willing to hold one man's word and the accolades and his reputation and his version of the story and his power and platform over one woman's word. And we always want to wait for women. We want that plural. And it's like, when are we going to believe women? And this idea and this mantra of believe women doesn't mean believe women without evidence. That's not the goal here. It's to believe a woman when they say that they have been harassed and when there's clear evidence and there needs to be justice. Research shows that by the time a girl's in middle school, she's been harassed. And boys, to be culturally accepted by other boys and girls, harassed to prove their quote unquote manhood. And it's this just broken system that starts in puberty and goes on, as we see, it's made its way from fraternity culture into adult life, where this is again celebrated, excused, joked about. And how many women, though, Sarah, I just want to stop and commend you, because that's one of the first stories I've heard where a girl that young didn't just freeze and be like, I guess this is what I'm for. I guess this is what my body's for. Mm-hmm. But to be like, this was wrong. No. And of course, as moms, we don't want to have these conversations that young.
No.
But we must. We must, for our children's protection, safety, and well-being, we must, because it's, if it hasn't already happened, it's about to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and again, it's one of those things I remember, you know, kind of, I was so proud of Tess. And of course, like when I got home, I wanted to make sure like she felt okay. And she's like, yeah, I'm good. And I remember like telling my ex-husband, I was like, this is why I talked to her about it. And I know that you think like I'm crazy. And you know, I alluded, like I was, you know, dating another guy at the time, telling this story over about like Harvey Weinstein. And he's like, this doesn't happen to everyone, Sarah. Like you're blowing this out of proportion. I'm like, it happens to everybody. It happens to everybody. But here's something cool that I really appreciate you talking about in your book. And obviously you make a very strong case in terms of gender oppression, that this is not just a human issue, but it is really a Christian issue. But you also talked about like, hey, who was one of like the most like woke people in the Bible in regards to gender oppression? And that was Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. So in the first century, women held no weight in a court of law. They, in fact, women couldn't even give testimony in court because they were accused, research shows, of looking for personal gain or fear of punishment. They were treated as low as a slave. They were truly property when they were quote unquote married. It was really an acquisition. It wasn't this like mutual respect, which is why we see so many people who had so many wives. This was more of like a farm, a breeding farm, than it was a mutual, respectful, engaged relationship. And then here comes on the scene, this man in the first century, well, women held no power politically, relationally, in the public square, nothing. They weren't owners of property, anything. And he entrusts them as equals to men. Mm-hmm. He's even, dare I say, more progressive even in our modern day. Jesus would have even been more progressive, giving women half leadership, half everything. And it's interesting, in the Christian circles, we hold a few passages by an apostle who comes a little later, who was an incredible man, who'd really encouraged women. And we twist and weaponize his words over the entire life of Jesus, who we believe is our Messiah, who believes we give new life, who came for us. So it's wild that we hold a man over the God-man. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, time and time again, so every encounter he had with women in the New Testament and in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is one of empowerment. It's one of equality. It's one of dignity, Sarah. The way he dignifies women, as other men and women around them are treating a woman of ill repute, he honors her. He calls them daughter, which in that language and in that time, for a rabbi or someone of high stature to call somebody daughter meant so much, to say like, not only are you the lowest of the low, I consider you my family. I consider you an heir. So I think for me, one of the reasons why I'm camping on this for the rest of my life, I'm willing to be wrong about this because I so believe in this, is because the most radical person to ever walk the earth enabled and empowered women, never subjugated, never silenced, never slandered. Mm-hmm. A popular passage, two things. A popular passage in with Jesus is the adulterous women, the Pharisees of the time, those who kept the law. They wanted to trap Jesus because they wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
Because he was radical and he was all about love and compassion. They wanted to kill him. So they trap him and they bring this woman that perhaps was set up to be caught in adultery. We don't really know if it was even real. She's accused of being caught in adultery. Mm-hmm. And they drag her out, and scholars say she was likely naked. Mm-hmm. They drag her out into the public square. Everyone's watching in town, and it's truly a trap. And they walk in because they want to trap Jesus, because they say, oh, well, what do you say? The law says she should be stoned for committing adultery. Mm-hmm. And he practices bystander intervention. He walks himself, his physical body, in between her and him. And then he looks to those who want to stone her. And he says, you without sin, you, like you've done anything wrong. How dare you? How dare you? Mm-hmm. And then once they've left, he dignifies her in a private conversation, not in front of everyone else, gets her up and says, go on your way. Just this idea of they made it all about killing him, and he made it all about protecting her and dignifying her. And then the entire message of Jesus, that he was the Messiah, that he died and rose again, was left on a woman's shoulder. It was a woman who came to the tomb and she sees nothing. She's like, oh my gosh, his body was stolen. So she goes and gets the boys, brings them back, Jesus' key men, and says, look. And then they leave and said, oh my gosh, he's gone. His body's been stolen or taken or who knows. And then they leave and she stays. And then Jesus reveals himself. He could have revealed himself when those men were there. He chose not to. That was a deliberate choice to reveal. The first time anyone saw him after he died and rose again was a woman. the entire message, again, when women held no testimony in the court of law, was to leave this message, this true testimony on the shoulders, this mantle on women. The rest of Christian history, you know, for thousands and thousands of years has relied on a woman's testimony, which is just so incredibly powerful. So when we talk about believe women, I look back to that story. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it. The most radical man to ever walk, the most radical man to ever empower and just believe in people on the margins, believed women. He walked with them and he empowered women, and we can do the same.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in your book that you ran into this person that you had, you know, witnessed, and that you were able to be peaceful about it and not have, you know, be anxious and to be able to kind of move forward. What were the steps that you took, or how were you able to get from, you know, this kind of like shattered place of being that person that spoke up, to kind of coming to the other side of this and then really being able to own your voice and again, like have that peace in yourself that like, I did the right thing and I see you and you don't have this effect on me, and I'm going to continue to lead with my words and with my faith. How'd you get there?
Yeah. Well, like anyone who's been in a situation, whether you're a whistleblower or whether you're a victim, there is so much victim blame and there is so much shaming. And I struggled with so long, Sarah, believing that this was my fault. I'd have dreams of him, of this system that was on fire. And I would run into this burning building. And he said, this is all burning to the ground because of you. So even in my dreams, I felt like this is my fault. This is all blowing up. So many lives are affected. So many jobs are affected because of me. And so once I moved to that understanding that it wasn't my full-time job to protect this man's issues and protect this man's misconduct, it wasn't my job to feel like the bad kid. It wasn't my job to own this and embody what he did. Even as a bystander, I felt somehow responsible. And that's what narcissists, that's what abusers of power do. They make the people who speak up feel responsible as if everything was their fault.
Right. They gaslight you.
So yeah. They gaslight to kingdom come. So once I worked through that and realizing I didn't do this, you did. You're being held responsible for your actions. Once I moved through that, his power was gone. His power over me was lost. And I was able to recognize myself for what I was, which was brave, strong, lending strength to other women in my situation and walking out truth, even if it meant annihilation to my character for a time, just for a time. Because at the end of the day, I'm not the one who abuses power at a woman's expense. He was. And so to be able to stand there, and Sarah, when I say he was right next to me, he was right behind me getting coffee in line at a coffee shop. And it was like, and I'm 5'1", he's much, much, much taller. And it was just this moment of like, oh, you're just a broken, flawed human being. And I will not let you destroy my life any longer. You have no hold over me. And just knowing that you don't get that power. I have given you so much power. You have groomed me to give it to you. And no longer will I see myself as the purveyor of a problem when you did this.
It's so awesome.
It was a beautiful feeling, I'll tell you what.
Oh yeah. I mean, because again, like that was kind of like the arc of the story in Pray Tell, like your own kind of narrative is like, here's where I started, but like, and you know, and you kind of talk at the beginning of the book, you're like, I'm here, like I'm seeing this person, and then just kind of wrapping up the book of just like, hey,
yeah,
like I've, you know, I understand my power, and I can almost have pity and compassion, because yeah, you are a broken person, but your brokenness does not have to affect me. Okay, so I'm going to pivot a little bit. Like, so you have this book. Is this your second or third book that you've written?
It's my fifth book contract. Holy crap. So I've written two books and two 50,000 word Bible studies.
Okay.
Examining Jesus and women and the intersection of justice and faith. And then this one is my fifth contract, but my technically trade book is what you would call it. Just like a regular book on a shelf. It's my third.
Okay. Cause I'm like, usually I'm pretty good about my statistics. So if I'm off, I was like, girl, Sarah, I usually do my research.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're, you know, doing, you know, having this whole book is coming out like during a pandemic. So, and just cause like, I just want to know, cause I'm curious. I am part of I wrote my first book chapter this past fall at 43 because I was like, what's something that I haven't done? And, you know, maybe I'd be interested in doing. And I got asked to write a chapter and I was like, okay, like I'm going to do this. Like everything was burning down in California. I'm like, we have to stay inside because the air quality is horrible. In Washington State, you guys had super terrible air quality too. So I was able to do a book chapter, but nowhere near like the fanfare that, you know, Pray Tell has. And I also don't have a Shelley. I don't have a publicist. You know, I might have to talk to her after this. So like walk us through like, so it's a pandemic. You have this book. This is a really incredible message. How are you working to like get this message across? I think there's a conference that's coming up that you're participating that is a collection of a lot of women that are kind of telling similar stories. Like tell us like, where can we find you? How can people learn more? Because like we want to just like, we want to bring our community to bear here. Cause I, like, I read this book and like literally every page I was like, I was like, yes, Tiffany. I was like, yes. I mean, just like, it was so relatable. And again, like everything you talked about, I was just like, I feel all of this. I've been through this. And so now I want to do more.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just want to say, for those listening, watching, like this truly is an intersectional approach to this issue, addressing women of color and class in this. And so, I would say I'd love for you to obviously order the book and join in this, but we have put together a virtual summit of leading voices on this issue, culture commentators, activists, scholars, a graduate professor on women's medieval history and how the medieval times shaped this issue, a leading psychologist, trauma psychologist. So there's incredible leading voices all at tiffanybloom.com, B-L-U-H-M.
Oh, which I'll put in the show notes. Don't get it twisted. And also with your Instagram and also why though, I have all of that.
Yay. So everything on my site, you can read about it. And this is, I just have to say, like, I'm just going to toot my own horn. It's a great book for your book club. And I know we're doing a book club with Defy, which I'm like,
why do you think we're leading out with this? Yeah.
But if you have other book clubs that you know of, like it is such a good book club book. And we've got book club questions and everything like that on tiffanybloom.com.
I know. And I can't wait for more. Okay. So sidebar, you live in Tacoma, which is where my sister lives. And you guys have had like crazy snow, but like now it's slush, but like now it's ice.
But no, then, ice, like, God. No ice. No ice.
Okay, good. And we were, you know, just saying like before we started recording, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, like they canceled like, you know, school because of like snow flurries. And, you know, you have two sons and my son is actually going to school in Tacoma right now at my sister's private school, Charles Wright, because he was flunking distance ed in California. And like, that's like pandemic life.
Yeah.
What's been like your silver mom lining for the pandemic?
Just okay, because I'm
now, now that we're approaching like a year, by the way, a year.
What I just want to let you know, Defy, you're my people. So I'm just going to give it to you straight. So here is what's keeping me alive right now.
Yes. Lay it on us.
Deep breaths. And I'm not even kidding you. I have a, just full disclosure, I have a child with some significant neurological delays and some trauma. And it's full court press 24/7 over here. Mm-hmm. Even in the middle of the night, waking up, and it's just, it's a lot. So I would say a lot of deep breaths, a lot of Madam Secretary, all six seasons. Mm-hmm. I love myself some MSEC, and a lot of chamomile tea at night, a lot of chamomile tea. And okay, I just got to be honest, the real thing that's been helping me feel like, but like not go crazy and just keel over from anxiety is, don't judge me, y'all, but I switched to decaf. What? Whole decaf, not a drop. I had to, Sarah. I was going crazy.
I had like
anxiety was killing me.
Yeah, I've been quadrupling my caffeine intake during quarantine, but you're saying like, hey, there's another way.
Okay, one more thing. Can I just say one more thing? Okay, yes. This is going a little bit India on you, so forgive me bringing your culture into this, but y'all got to go to the Whole Foods and get yourself some ashwagandha.
Okay.
The Ayurvedic way of doing things, they know what's up. There's a reason they've been doing it for thousands and thousands of years to take care of the body and wellness. Ashwagandha with stress and mental fogginess. And it's supposedly supposed to help with cravings. I don't think it does. But I will say for the stress, it has changed my life. I'm going to be that bold. I'm going to say it. It's changed my life. Ashwagandha, y'all. Ashwagandha.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to have to add ashwagandha to the show notes. And mostly, I just want to say thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this all week. Thank you so much for having me.
I know. This is like so fun.
It's really fun.
Yeah. And especially just because like I love the book and I'm just like a voracious reader. So I was like, oh my God, I get to talk to Tiffany. And then we get to do it again when we have like the Defy Reads kickoff in March.
Okay. So this will also, just be like, You're an incredible communicator and you should be podcasting. Not everybody should be doing this. Can I just say that? Not everybody should be podcasting. Like,
just because you can
doesn't mean you should buy a Yeti and do it. You were built for this.
Thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support and we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you, because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.